Good morning. I'd like you to be opening your Bibles this morning. Book of Genesis, chapter 39. Genesis 39. Read and talk about what we find there this morning. Genesis, chapter 39. Appreciate your presence this morning. Glad to see you. Glad that you are here with us. We have visitors among us. We are especially exhilarated and encouraged by your worshiping God with us here today. If you've never been to Kleinwood before, but this is your first time with us, love for you to have a visitor's packet. And do hope that you, if you haven't gotten one already, you'll get one before you leave this morning and make good use of the information that you'll find therein. We're glad that you're worshiping with us today. It's been a busy weekend here in this congregation. We had good singing Friday night. Appreciate all those who helped and worked to make that possible. And certainly above all, we hope that God was glorified and the people who were here were edified by what happened in this place. That's a big thing, something that we look forward to every year. It's good work, and we're thankful to be a part of it. Genesis chapter 39 in your Bible this morning. If you have kids in sort of our kids' classes, they're doing the Joseph story right now. And that's, of course, a story that's very applicable to young people. But Joseph is a great story for anybody of any age. We talked about Joseph a couple weeks ago together. We're going to talk about Joseph some more this morning. Book of Joseph, or the story of Joseph, rather, is something that just absolutely captures the imagination. It's a story that just, what the story consists of is amazing. The way it is told is profound. It's a story that can speak to us, no matter who we are, how old we are, or where we are at. The problem that most of us have in life is that life just doesn't seem to go the way we plan for it to go. Doesn't go like we planned for it to. Let me ask you a question this morning, especially if you're a 40 or over this morning. You don't necessarily raise your hand, but I just want you to think with me for a moment this morning, especially those of you who are 40 or over. Honestly, probably a lot of people by the time you're 30 even. If you're 40 or over this morning, let me ask you, how many of you are exactly where you thought you would be at this point in life when you graduated high school? Everything planned, everything unfolded just like you planned. When you were 17, 18 years old, you're coming out of high school, you are exactly where you thought you would be. And you say, yeah, I got here, Jeff, it's exactly where I wanted to be. How many of you, you are where you expected to be, but you got there the way you thought you would when you were 17 or 18? I don't know about you, but where I thought I'd be when I was 17 or 18, it was over by the time I was 21. Life has a way of never unfolding, rarely, if ever, unfolding the way we expect and plan and even want, desire, hope, and dream. There's just something about it. You know, and again, if you live much time at all, you know this deep down. You've experienced it. You've lived it. You know it all too well, maybe. Because maybe you're sitting there this morning and you're living a life of dashed hopes, dashed dreams. Something is, maybe the way your life has gone is something that pulls you down. Something has happened that maybe you've never recovered from. It ought to be a stark reminder in some ways that we are not in control, that life is not ours to basically discern and design for our own purposes and in our own way. I don't care who you are, if you have any age and experience of life this morning, probably at least in the area of your family or maybe the area of your career, maybe the area of your finances, you are not where you thought you would be when you started out. The story of Joseph is so compelling. One of the reasons that the story of Joseph is so compelling is because of the power of the stunning reversals that make up the course of Joseph's life in the Bible as the story is told. From young man who's probably become heir to his father's household, given the way his father has disowned some of his older brothers, to young man who is given dreams by God about future glory, to young man who is in the pit while his brothers debate whether or not they even kill him, to young man who was sold into slavery and taken to Egypt, to young man who was falsely accused of rape while a slave in Egypt, to young man who finds himself in prison in Egypt. But intermixed with all these downward trends are moments of redemption and moments of hope. There's the period when, even though he's a slave in Egypt, he becomes the highest of servants in Potiphar's house, a high-ranking Egyptian official. He rises to the top. It's a period where even in prison, he basically rises to be assistant warden, co-warden of the prison, despite what's going on. Eventually, he rises all the way to the pinnacle of Egypt itself, second only to Pharaoh himself, which would make Joseph, in a sense, the second most powerful man in the world of his day. You almost get whiplash following the life of Joseph around, the highs, the lows. And again, it's a story we read in a couple of minutes. This is a young man's life, and this is years
of his life. We talked about this, that aspect, especially a couple of weeks ago. Years of his life pass, and the low points. Years of his life not knowing how it's going to turn out, how the dreams that God has given him might come to pass. Perhaps even if he were any bit human like you or I, or maybe even beginning to wonder if they will come to pass. Maybe it was more just a hallucination. Maybe they aren't real. Maybe I made it up. Maybe I misinterpreted. Maybe I misunderstood. Well, for you or I, is a couple of pages in 10 minutes. Is years of life and suffering and endurance and doors closed and no one to open them and no sure explanation or understanding of how it's going to turn out. It's a profound and powerful story. And again, part of the power of the story is the fact that when you see it through Joseph's eyes, you realize even when God tells you what he's going to do, as he did with Joseph in his early days when he's 17 years old, even if you know what God tells you he's going to do in the future, it doesn't mean that the way you're going to get there is going to be smooth, pleasant, comfortable, or convenient. Which, by the way, has plenty of analogy to Christians today. Even though God says he's coming back, I'm going to send Jesus back. Jesus is going to return. The world is going to end. Wickedness is going to be judged. Righteousness rewarded. Heaven will come and hell will be meted out. Even though God has told us what's going to happen, it doesn't mean that the road there in the meantime will be pleasant or easy or comfortable. And Genesis chapter 39, perhaps, especially in the part of Joseph's story that we find in these familiar verses, these 21 or so verses in this chapter, 23 verses in this chapter, we find especially a facet of Joseph's life that is so human and so real to so many of us. Because it involves very much somebody who's in a situation out of their control. They didn't want to be in this situation, didn't ask for this situation in the first place. Do everything right. Somebody does something that's wrong. Their reputation is ruined. Their freedom, in Joseph's case, is taken away. Everything beyond their control. Why don't you read this part of the story with me again this morning? We'll talk about it a little bit. Maybe see some things we haven't seen before and think together a little bit about how this story teaches us about how to live life for God well. In a world where if we stop and think about it, most of us are already not where we ever intended to be. How do we live well and for God when we are forced to acknowledge that life is beyond our control, so much of it? Chapter 39, verse 1. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard, brought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, so he became a successful man. And by the way, they stop right there for just a moment. In that study, and that refrain is going to be repeated a lot in this chapter about how the Lord was with Joseph, some variation of it. The Lord was with Joseph and he prospered him. And I want you to notice something. Again, it's not just that the story is told. What's important is how the story is told. And before we even know what happens to Joseph, he goes into Potiphar's house, the text just simply emphasizes, lest we, maybe even more than Joseph, as readers, are tempted to doubt. The Lord is with Joseph in this, and he will be successful. Don't even know how or why you think about it. You know the story already. You know what's going to happen. If you're reading this for the first time, you don't know that. How the story is told matters. The text wants to make very clear, no misunderstandings, no doubts. Despite what this looks like, and despite what it may look like in your life sometimes, the people of God are not abandoned by their Lord. The Lord was with Joseph, so he became a successful man. Well, how can that be? Well, read on. He was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. Now his master saw that the Lord was with him and how the Lord caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. And by the way, isn't it ironic that sometimes the people around us, sometimes people who don't even necessarily fear God or confess him, sometimes the people around us can see more hope and more possibility in our situation than we can ourselves. Sometimes when you just simply try to do what's right and try to be the kind of person, have the kind of character that God expects, sometimes even if you don't think you're in a very good place, the world is noticing things. Before the text even begins to tell us what Joseph thinks or even what Joseph's doing, the text says Potiphar noticed something about this guy and about his God. So Joseph found favor in his sight and became his personal servant. And he made him overseer over his house. And all that he owned he put in his charge. And it came about that from the time he made him overseer in his house, over all that he owned, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house on the account of Joseph. Now again, that's a fascinating way to put it, isn't it? On Joseph's account. In other words, not because Potiphar deserved it, but because God's man was there. And so for Joseph's benefit, in a sense. The Lord blessed Potiphar. Thus the Lord's blessing was upon all that he owned in the house and in the field. So he left everything he owned in Joseph's charge. And with him there, he did not concern himself with anything except the food which he ate. Ah, the life. Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. And it came about after these events. So things have gone well. How long? No, the text doesn't say. Presumably some period of time for Joseph to rise up through the ranks, for Potiphar to notice these things again. Just a couple of moments for you and I to read it. Probably is some period of time in Joseph's life for him to go through this. And again, the text tells us this, but it doesn't tell us that Joseph necessarily knew this or recognized this. Hindsight's always 20/20, isn't it? So Joseph was handsome in form and appearance, and it came about after these things that his master's wife looked with desire at Joseph. And she said, "Lie with me." But he refused and said to his master's wife, "Behold, with me here, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house, and he has put all that he owns in my charge. There is no one greater in the house than I, and he has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do this great evil and sin against God?" And finally, by the way, in those words, and this often happens, some of you heard me talk about this before, especially in the Old Testament, this often happens, where character is revealed by what people say. Jesus even hinted at this in the New Testament, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. Remember that? And so here's Joseph, and finally, we're not told so much, you know, this is what's going on in Joseph's minds or hearts, but he opens his mouth and we find out something. What's going on in Joseph's mind? Has he given up on God? Has he given in to doubt, despair, bitterness, anything of the sort? No. By the way, is he fully assured of his power and the position that he has attained to? Yeah, there's nobody greater in the house than I. How rare is it for somebody to have authority, know they have authority, and not abuse the authority? There's none greater in the house than I, but you're not mine to have. And above all, he doesn't just say just for Potiphar's sake, or because I fear Potiphar, or the consequences, or the scandal, or the tabloids, or the pictures, or the internet. How could I then do this great evil and sin against God? How could I wrong my God? Well, Joseph, God's abandoned you. Your family has sold you out. You're a slave, maybe a high position slave, but you're a slave. Your life is not your own. You don't decide where you go and when you want to go there. You aren't free to leave when you want to leave. My God is still in control. I still fear my God. I serve my God. I cannot do this evil and sin against God. And verses 10 and 11, in some ways perhaps, the most profound part of the story. Because we often, again, you know, and even maybe you're like me sometimes, we get stuck in our kids' Bible class mode of how we heard these stories growing up. And it's one of those just, you know, Joseph has this one encounter and this one great moment of decision, and he makes the right decision, and good for him. It's not the case. Verse 10, 11, Joseph spoke day after day, or she spoke to Joseph day after day. He did not listen to her, to lie beside her or be with her. It wasn't just a one-time decision for Joseph. It wasn't just one great heroic moment, and I did it, and I move on. But it happened one day that he went in the house to do his work. He's a responsible man. To fulfill the duties and obligations of his role. Well, he's the greatest in the house. He probably has people for that. Yeah, he's going to do his job. So he went in that house to do his work. None of the men of the house were there inside. And so now, advantage woman. She caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." He left his garment in her hand, fled, went outside. When she saw that he left his garment in her hand and fled outside, she called to the men of the household, said to him, "See, he has brought in a Hebrew." See, no matter how long you are in some places, no matter how good a job you do, you never quit being the other guy, that person. No matter how long you've been in the place, no matter how well you do your job, even if God's blessing you, to some people you'll never quit being that guy, that other person, that outsider, that foreigner, the guy with the funny accent, the guy who looks different. She spoke the words that her husband has brought in a Hebrew to us to make sport of us. He came in to me to lie with me, and I screamed. When he heard that I raised my voice and screamed, he left his garment beside me and fled and went outside. And so she left his garment beside her until his master came home. And then she spoke to him with these words, "The Hebrew slave whom you brought to us." You know how it always works when you come home? It's always you and yours when you're in trouble. this Hebrew slave you brought to us came in to me to make sport of me, and as I raised my voice and screamed, he left his garment beside me and fled outside. Now when the master heard the words of his wife, which she spoke to him, saying, this is what your slave did to me, his anger burned. By the way, it's interesting. Sometimes commentators over the years, they'll know this, and they'll say, you know, Potiphar could have had Joseph killed, but he didn't. He just has him in prison instead, which maybe Potiphar didn't believe, you know, Joseph. Maybe he knew his wife and how she was, you know, and he didn't really believe that Joseph had done this. That's why he didn't have him put to death. He just had him thrown in prison. Keep her happy, but not put Joseph to death. He's a good guy. Good things happen when the guy's around. I don't want to kill him, but I've got to placate the wife. Well, it is odd that he does not have Joseph put to death, but the text is very clear. His anger burned. In other words, Potiphar didn't just roll his eyes and, oh, here she goes again. His anger burned. At least on some level, he accepted this as so. And so Joseph's master took him and put him into the jail, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in the jail. But the Lord was with Joseph. Oh, there's that idea again, that refrain. The narrator never wants us to lose sight of that. And again, even before he tells you what's going to happen, how good's going to come out of the evil, he lets you make sure. Because sometimes maybe you and I need the faith in God more than Joseph did in the situation. And the Lord was with Joseph and extended kindness to him and gave him favor in the sight of the chief jailer. And so the chief jailer committed to Joseph's charge all the prisoners who were in the jail so that whatever was done there, he was responsible for it. The chief jailer did not supervise anything under Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made him prosper. Just when you think your life can't get any more difficult if you're Joseph, I'm a slave, even a well-positioned slave. My master's good enough, but his wife, don't get me started about his wife. She never takes no for an answer. His wife's a problem. Just when you think life can't get any more difficult, and to her, you're still the Hebrew. You're still the outsider. You're still that guy. And now you're in prison. What's the way out of prison? When you live in a time and a place with no rights and no legal options, you're a foreigner, you're a slave, and Potiphar's wife still never lets you forget that. You're still the Hebrew. You're a foreigner and a slave. What's the way out if you're Joseph? Where do you hang your hope? How do you keep faith in the dreams that you've had? Stars and sheaves bowing down. When every time you think maybe you've turned a corner, it's getting better, it's pulled out from under you again. And yet he does. Because God's person always does. God's person finds a way to keep believing even when we don't understand. Even when I have a vision for how my life might go. Remember, Joseph's just 17 or so and he has that dream. Where were you and what were you thinking when you were 17? How has your life gone? Here's Joseph. He has these dreams, these visions, God-given no less at 17. And yet here's his life hardly going according to plan, or so it appears. How do you and I, ladies and gentlemen, how do you and I live life well when we are forced to accept, to confront, to admit, to acknowledge that it's ultimately beyond our control? Joseph's story forces us to think about that. I want to quickly, in the last couple bits that we had together this morning, think about four or so things about living life beyond our control. Living well, living for God, keeping the faith. Let me quickly make four observations with you, and we'll be through for our time together this morning. Number one, life may be out of our control so much, but number one, we control what we can control by number one, we can control our attitude. We can control our attitude. I'll tell you, the more I think about it, the more I am shocked and stunned. And not just does Joseph say no to sexual desire itself and the temptation for a young man without a wife in a position of vulnerability like him, that he continues to say no, but that he says no for the reason that he says no. He doesn't say no because he's afraid he'll get in trouble, or he's afraid he'll get caught, that he might lose his life. What happens if somebody finds out? What happens if she gets pregnant? He says no because of God and his relationship with God. And I cannot wrong my God. I can't see any. There's a sense in which God hasn't necessarily, at least at this point, done what he said he'd do for me, but I will not do him wrong. I can control my attitude toward God. And Job, another story in the Bible, another one of those famous stories where you have somebody who does nothing wrong and yet everything goes wrong. In the book of Job, remember in Job chapter 2, as he's lost everything, and he's lost his wealth, and he's lost his family, and he's lost his children, And then Job chapter 2, verse 9 and 10, you have the conversation, the exchange between Job and his wife. And what I think is so powerful and profound about that exchange is between those two people, you literally have the two possible reactions to what happens when life goes wrong and out of our control. In Job 2 and verse 9, the wife says to him, "Do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die." To which Job, the opposite possibility in verse 10, says, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God and not accept adversity?" And in all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Two possible reactions: blame God or submit to God. Two possible reactions. And you know what? We are always in control of that. I cannot control what happens around me. I will never necessarily know the mysteries of why God runs the world the way he does and why God has assigned me my part in it. But I can control my attitude. Joseph continued to say, "I will not wrong my God." Job can rebuke his wife. "Your attitude is wrong. You have chosen the easy way out." That actually solves nothing. Cursing God, giving up on God, blaming God. God has failed. The magnitude of what both of those men, Joseph and Job, the magnitude of what both those men have been through. They have lost everything. That's beyond their control. But would they lose their relationship with God? Well, that's always in our control. And I will tell you this morning, ladies and gentlemen, never confuse pain and tears and frustration with a situation with bitterness. With bitterness. Bitterness is what's dangerous. Tears and pain and frustration, that's different. Even the Apostle Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 1, the Apostle Paul says, "We don't want you to be unaware, brethren, of our affliction which came to us in Asia, that we were burdened excessively beyond our strength, so that we despaired even of life." It was hard, and we were frustrated and depressed and beaten down, and we despaired. That's different than bitterness. Despair, frustration, is just acknowledging that life is hard and pain is real. Bitterness is when I allow that pain and that frustration and that suffering and that hardship to become the foundation of my attitude toward life and toward God and toward myself and toward others. And so Paul writes in Ephesians 4 and verse 30, "Don't grieve the Holy Spirit of God by whom you were sealed for the day of redemption. Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander be put away from you along with all malice." Get rid of the bitterness, Paul says. And again, I want you to notice it's at the head of the list: wrath, anger, clamor, slander. When we allow the wrongs that have been done to us to become our attitude towards life and reality, towards God and towards others and even toward ourselves, when we allow it to put down roots, when it becomes the foundation and the substance and the basis, that's different. And that's dangerous. I cannot control what happens to me, but I can control my attitude about it. I can control whether or not I say I fear God or whether or not I decide to curse God. Number two, I can control my actions. I can control my actions. Isn't it paradoxical? Joseph is a slave. There's a sense in which he does not belong to himself in that culture, that legal system, that way of living back in that time. His body was no longer his own. He belonged to Potiphar. He was owned by that man. That man was his master. And yet, even though he was a slave, he could still decide ultimately whether or not he would control his actions. His body may be owned, but his actions ultimately were still his to decide. He can control his actions. You know, there will always be some things that we can't change about life and our situation and our fortunes and our circumstances. There's some things that are always going to be, they're going to be beyond our control that we cannot change. Let me ask you, what are you going to do about that? How are you going to respond to that? See, Joseph, so much of what drives Joseph's story are the things that he cannot control. Joseph cannot control what his brothers choose to do. Joseph cannot control what Potiphar does. Joseph cannot control what Potiphar's wife does and says. Joseph cannot control what the baker and the butler in prison do. Joseph cannot control what the warden decides to do. Joseph certainly cannot control what God in heaven will do. But even though he's a slave, he can still control what he's going to do. He can do right. He can work hard. He can refuse to repay in kind. He can stay faithful. He can start over again and again, even when his life gets knocked further down. He can refuse to fight with and become bitter over the things he cannot control. But he can control his actions. Number three, we can always control our perspective. Even beyond our attitude, we can control our perspective, our outlook on life itself. We can control our perspective. See, one of the greatest temptations that often comes our way, one of the greatest temptations is to quit doing right when doing right gets us nowhere, when good results don't happen, when we do what we're supposed to do and yet it still all goes wrong, when we do what we're supposed to do and others actually punish us for it, when we do what we're supposed to do and God doesn't reward us immediately. One of the greatest temptations, and so many people either give in to discouragement or even give up on God altogether, when they do right, because most people deep down on some level want to do right, at least to a certain extent, when we do right and yet still, it goes wrong. Well, I can control my perspective that right is always right, regardless of what happens. I can control my attitude, my perspective on the ultimate reality, that right is right, even if in this world it's called wrong. I can continue to do what's right, even if the results are tragic or unfair or unjust. Now, I'll tell you, that's counterintuitive. That's a different way of looking at life and reality. It's a different perspective. Because especially in our culture, in the way we do things, productivity, that's about the most efficient way to accomplish, to achieve, to acquire what I want. Well, keep doing something that doesn't work. Why would you do that? Well, if my perspective is, it works if I get what I want right here and right now, well then yeah, it doesn't make a lot of sense. But if my perspective is broader, it's worth doing what's right even when I don't get treated rightly or rewarded rightly for it now. Because I have a bigger perspective, a different picture. That's not just counterintuitive, that's countercultural. We live in a world that demands and expects and wonders about those who don't desire instant gratification. You ever refuse to do something that yields immediate results and somebody looks at you like you're crazy and asks you, why would you do that? It's not just counterintuitive, it's countercultural. God's people are possessed of an eternal perspective, of eternal definitions of right and wrong, of value, of worth and reward. God's people are possessed of a perspective that understands that problems and reversals are always, when defined by eternity, short-term problems, even if they last your whole life in this world. Psalm 73, one of my favorite psalms in the Bible. Honest because it confesses, I nearly gave up my faith in God when I looked at the world and how it's run and how the wicked get away with everything and the righteous often wind up under their feet. Until he says, verse 17, until I came into the sanctuary of God, and then I perceived there the wicked, their end. Until I fixed my perspective. I can't control how God runs the world. I can't control what the wicked do, but I can control my big picture vision of reality and my place in it. It's stunning. In Psalm 105, that psalm gives a little bit of commentary and insight on the Joseph story. I don't know if you knew that before, but sometimes the Bible, especially in certain historical psalms, goes back and has very interesting ways of retelling and thinking about stories that you know from the narrative parts of the Bible. In Psalm 105, beginning of verse 17, here the psalmist comes back to the Joseph story. Listen to how the psalm looks at the story of Joseph. In Psalm 105, beginning of verse 17, speaking of God, God sent a man before them. And he's telling ultimately in the context of the psalm the story of how Israel becomes Israel. And so already from that perspective, Joseph's life is not just about Joseph. Joseph's life is in a much larger perspective about how is God going to get his people into Egypt like he told Abraham he would so that he can get them out of Egypt, a great nation. And so God sent a man before them, Joseph. You hear that? So who's really still in control despite what it looks like? Well, God is. Oh no, Joseph's in Egypt. We got to come up with plan B now. No. God sent a man before them, Joseph, sold as a slave. They afflicted his feet with fetters. He himself was laid in irons. It doesn't downplay the suffering and tragic elements of the story. until the time, listen now, verse 19, until the time that his word came to pass, the word of the Lord tested him. Now, there is a stunning way to tell the story. Until these dreams that Joseph had, until they came to pass, the word of the Lord tested Joseph. How to do that? Well, because Joseph had to ultimately wrestle and had to grow in wrestling with, is this going to come to pass or not? Can I trust God or not? Will God fulfill what he has told me he would do or not? And the psalmist makes no mistake, says, make no mistake, Joseph is every bit as human as you or I are. That's what the psalmist is getting at. Those years in prison, those years of enslavement, those years of injustice, those years of suffering, until the time that the word came to pass, the word of the Lord tested him. It tested him. It forced Joseph to decide who he is and who he's going to be. It forced Joseph to decide what he's going to do about the things that are beyond his control and how he's going to allow them to affect him and what he's going to do about the things that are in his control, his attitude, his actions, and his perspective. And Joseph passes the test because, as many of you are well aware, when you get to the end of the story in Genesis chapter 50, when you get to the end of the story of Joseph and he's talking to his brothers after their father has died, and I will tell you from personal experience, families get honest with each other after the matriarch or patriarch passes away. I've seen it before. All the water in the bridge over the years comes rushing back, and everything that we kept under wraps and under control for mom or dad's sake, once they're gone, now it all comes back to the surface. And Joseph's family was no different. And now Jacob is gone, and the brothers think that now Joseph, for the dad's sake, maybe he hadn't done anything yet, but now that dad's dead, Joseph's going to get us. And Joseph, in Genesis chapter 50 and verse 19, says to them, do not be afraid, for am I in God's place? Do I run the world? Do I determine fortunes in life? Do I decide who lives and dies? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive. Do you think about what Joseph says there at that point in his life? What the psalmist is trying to get us to understand about Joseph. Until the time the word came to pass, the word of the Lord tested that young man. He learned the lesson. And many of the most important lessons, ladies and gentlemen, as you and I are probably all too familiar but don't want to remember, many of the best and most important lives only come through painful experiences. When we are forced to purify our perspective, among other things, on who God is, how he works, and how we will react. And number four, quickly and finally this morning, Number four, I can control my faithfulness. I can control my faithfulness. I can't control what other people do to me. I can't control what other people say about me. I can't control how other people treat me. I cannot control God's plan and God's will for my life. I cannot control how God may allow things to enter my life and how God may allow things to happen to me in my life. But I can control my faithfulness. In Hebrews chapter 11, that famous passage, you know, most of the chapter, as most of you, I think, are well familiar with, most of that chapter is consumed with the Hebrew writer going back and talking about the faithfulness, the great faith of great men and women of faith, people like Abraham, people like Noah, people like Abel, and talking about how great their faith is and how faithful they were to God. And most of you are very, I think, ultimately familiar with the fact that later in that chapter, toward the end, and not for a whole lot of space, but toward the end of that chapter, starting about verse 35 or so, the Hebrew writer admits that while some had happy endings, and some were faithful to God, had great faith in life, and things worked out well for them, others were tortured, not accepting their release that they might obtain a better resurrection. Others experienced mockings and scourgings, chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, sawn in two, tempted, put to death with the sword. They went about in sheepskins, goatskins, destitute, afflicted, ill-treated, wandering in deserts and mountains and caves and holes in the ground. And all these having gained approval through their faith. Hear that? They were faithful too. didn't look like it on the surface. They were faithful. And what's most important is when you turn the page into chapter 12 and verse 1, since we are surrounded, the Hebrew writer says, with this great cloud of witnesses. Cloud of witnesses, not just the Abrahams and the Davids, but the ones whose names we don't even know, who were just as faithful and yet who died so horribly in their time and their place. I cannot control how my life will turn out. I cannot control what will be done to me. I cannot control what God's will is. But I can control my faithfulness. That I will be refined in the fire rather than being purged in the fire. That I will become more pure and closer to God, more committed to Him because I've sacrificed so much for Him. I can control my faithfulness. And what's ironic is you look at it on one level, that's not the message a lot of people want to hear. That's not the message a lot of people want to hear. A lot of people want to hear the message about how you do good things for God. There's a lot of churches that are or congregations that are filled today with people drawn to a message about you do stuff for God and God's going to make your life great. The Bible never says that. Oh, that message will preach and a lot of people will come and want to hear it, but it's not true. You hear something like this morning, it seems almost anticlimactic. Basically just, you know, put on a strong face and soldier on. Keep calm and carry on. And yet the irony is this exact approach to life has beaten kings and tyrants at their own game, has shaken kingdoms to their foundation, because ultimately, even though it looks so powerless and impotent, it is an extremely powerful way of living, because ultimately it says to those who are evil and in the wrong, those who would oppress us and deny Jesus as Lord, that no matter what they do to us, no matter how much they bring all the power that this world has to offer to bear on us, they cannot defeat us. You know, history tells us one of the things the Romans eventually figured out. They kept on martyring Christians, and they realized all they were doing was making Christians stronger. Because the Christians in their martyrdom had a form of power that Rome and all its greatness could not defeat. The power of people so fully convinced in their God and what their God's word says that they would die for it. What do you do to a people who aren't afraid to die? For whom death is an enemy that's been defeated, and the resurrection of their Lord and Savior. It may not be what you want to hear, but it's what you need to hear. An extremely powerful and victorious way of approaching life by acknowledging we are out of control and by yielding what we can control back to God's purposes and God's will. God help us to do that and have the courage to do that. And in so doing, tap into His strength, who Himself entered this world, lived this very way. Remember Jesus' own prayer when He's God made flesh, not my will but thine be done. And in so doing, defeated Satan himself, destroyed the kingdom of evil, and reasserted the reign of God over reality for all of eternity. If you're here this morning, you want to be part of God's kingdom, and you want to tap into the power of an indestructible life, the power of God to make your life what it ought to be this morning. Not to fix your problems here now, but to make you the human being that He created you in His image to be. We want to help you with that this morning. If you're here this morning and are ready to confess from a heart full of faith that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, repenting of your sins, we'll be happy to baptize you for the forgiveness of those sins this morning. If you're here this morning, you're a child of God already, but you have not been living for your God. Unlike Joseph, you've forgotten whose you are and why you live. To pray to God for forgiveness, however you feel this morning. If we can help you, encourage you, strengthen you in any way, why don't you come talk to us and share with us right now as we stand and as we sing.
Oh, Lord, God, so...